The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Gorgeous day here at Edstone. Beautiful, sunshiny day. A little bit of a cool day as well. We've had some frost for the last few mornings, so it's nice to see the sunshine melting that away. And I can't believe we're nearly through the month of January. The winter is moving by quickly. Over the weekend, our Key of David program here in the UK did quite well. We had over 100 calls just on the Sunday play of that program. I think the total count as of right now is 154 requests for, I forget all the booklets that we offered, but we have a hard time getting the King of the South out there just because the station here doesn't like newsy programs. So when we get when we produce programs on more of a newsy topic, we just have to be careful to try to get the program on through, as frustrating as that is. So we did talk about some pretty recent events in the Middle East with the killing of Soleimani and the surrounding the embassy and all those things. And so, yeah, to get the King of the South and a couple of other booklets offered on that program, we were really happy with that. We have another one, by the way, that will be playing this weekend, and also, I think, on some newsier subjects. But that has to do with the sudden destruction that so many prophecies talk about coming upon our nations. So we'll give you some updates on that one next Monday, perhaps. Well, the Prince and Meghan, they wanted a soft Megxit, as it's been called, but the Queen has the final say, and she opted for the hard Megxit on Saturday night. The Queen's statement Saturday evening, according to the Telegraph, it represents the hardest Megxit possible for the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Sky News says the Queen brought down the iron fist. That's some of the reporting from over here in the UK. Harry's royal status, his princely status, has essentially been dissolved. No, there's no more His Royal Highness. They lose their status as Prince Harry or Princess Meghan. Now it's just Harry, the Duke of Sussex. The Queen announced, too, that they'd have to repay for the refurbishments to their Forgemore cottage. I think that amounts to something like £2.4 million. Spent a lot of money refurbishing the place. He's now out of the military. He lost his status as Captain General of the Royal Marines. He's no longer entitled to wear the military uniform. And then he's not going to be representing the Queen of England in any official capacity. So, as I say, a pretty hard break for these two young people. There's still a few lingering questions, like with respect to security and whether or not, particularly if they live in Canada, if they're going to receive security provided by the royal family here. Princess Diana, she voluntarily gave up her official security back in the 1990s. And of course, her life ended in tragedy in Paris. So there's also questions regarding the rent. They're going to be charged rent now. They have to pay back the money for all the renovations. But then if they stay at the cottage here in the UK, they're going to be charged rent for the whole year. And I guess the question is, what happens if they go back and forth? What kind of rent will they have to pay? In any event, Richard gave us some of his thoughts here this morning, saying that he wouldn't be surprised now if things calm down a bit for the royal family, since Prince Harry has at least has a lot of respect for the Queen. I don't think you can say the same thing about the way he views his own father. But he does respect the Queen. And Richard's sense is that maybe Harry and Meghan will keep quiet and not give the big tell-all interview until after the Queen dies and his father then becomes king. In any event, it is refreshing in many ways to see the Queen, you know, the buck stops with her, but it's refreshing to particularly with a monarchy that really doesn't have a whole lot of power, but here she is using her authority to say, okay, if that's your decision, then it's not going to be a soft break or a soft exit. It's a hard Megxit. The Telegraph says here, while the events of the past 10 days will undoubtedly have taken their toll on our 93-year-old monarch, Her Majesty's decisive action over the Duke and Duchess of Sussex not only reminds us who is boss, but why. It reminds us who is boss and what the monarchy is here to do. Here she is exercising some authority, making the clean break. It's nice to see the adults acting like adults should act. Over the weekend, Meghan's father was interviewed and listened to the estranged father, I guess I should say. Meghan doesn't have a very good relationship with her dad either, but listen to what her father had to say in an interview over the weekend, clip one.
When they got married, they took on an obligation, and the obligation is to be part of the royals and to represent the royals, and it would be foolish for them not to. This is like one of the greatest long living institutions ever. They're destroying it. They're keeping it. They're making it shabby. They're turning it into a Walmart with a crown on it now.
That's Meghan's father saying they're cheapening the institution of the royal family. And when they got married, they took on an obligation to be part of the royals. And the royals, as we'll cover even again in the next segment, we touched on this last Monday as well, but they're here to serve. The monarchy's not there to serve them. It's the other way around. And so, as I say, the adults behaving like adults. It's refreshing. You don't see it much today. And of course, when they do this, when they behave like adults, then the majority in our culture, certainly in the media, they're always going to side with the rebellious young people, the rebellious students, the rebellious youths. We see it over and over again. Returning to the Telegraph here, it says the Queen and royal family have not only lost one of their most popular figures, but a prince whose marriage to a mixed-race American divorcee had heralded the dawn of a new progressive era for the House of Windsor. Now the dream is over. See, this is why so many in the press rejoiced when she was brought into the family, because she's of a mixed race. She's been divorced. Why, this is going to lead the House of Windsor into this new progressive era. And all that comes crashing down. It wasn't supposed to end like this. So when it does, as I covered last week, then you have all of the people out there, the critics, crying out, well, it has to be racism then. Because here's this white family basically banishing these two young people. And this very progressive woman, Lawrence Fox, I'm not too familiar with his work. He's an actor, evidently, but he was on Question Time last week. That's on Thursday nights here in the UK. And he's a middle-aged white actor, and one of the audience members speaks up during Question Time and says, well, let's be clear, this is obviously racism. And to his credit, he pushes back, this actor, this British actor. Here's clip two.
Let's be really clear about what this is. Let's call it by its name. It's racism.
We're the most tolerant, lovely country in Europe. Let's celebrate our
What worries me about your comment is you are a white, privileged male who has no experience.
I mean, can I just...
I can't help what I am. I was born like this. It's an immutable characteristic. So to call me a white, privileged male is to be racist.
Unfortunately,
you're being racist.
You cannot dismiss.
Okay.
You don't often hear that, certainly not from movie stars or TV stars, whatever he is. But he says here, pushing back, you're a white privileged male. And then he says, well, you're racist. You're racist for saying that. How can I help who I am or what I am? You wish more people would speak up and say that. He even drew attention. We pointed this out last week. He drew attention. He made the same point, essentially, that we made. Where here you have all these charges of racism right and left. And then meanwhile, you have these grooming gangs in the north of England that get away with rape and child abuse. And we're not even supposed to bring up their race. We can't be insensitive, you see. Here's clip 4.
It's one of the dangerous things about throwing racism around in this country, which we're doing a lot at the moment, is people become so conscious of it that things like the Manchester grooming scandal get ignored. So that, you know, we need to be careful that we need to call out racism when it's seen, when it's obvious and when it's there, and we should stand together to condemn it. But for fear of sounding racist, there's been horrific things have happened in Manchester and in towns all over the north of England, and we should be careful and use racism when it's there and it's obvious and not call someone racist just because they don't agree with you.
That's what it boils down to for so many. If they don't agree with the radical left, then they must be racist or a misogynist or whatever the charge might be. But coming back to the royal family here, you're well aware, many of you, of the New Throne of David book and the point that my father makes about this new revelation from January of 2017. The time when the royal family here in the UK... The British royal family was displaced as the royal family on David's throne, King David's throne. It wasn't even that long ago. Queen Victoria, she saw herself as a descendant of David. All of that history, though, that glorious history, has been long since forgotten. But God is raising the ruins, not just of Herbert Armstrong's work, he's raising the ruins of King David's throne. And that's why we see the royal family here in Britain in such turmoil. It says here, this is my father, back in 2017, that was a signal, that new revelation, of terrible things to come upon Britain, as well as a sharp decline of America and Judah. It was also an indication that we would see a rapid decline in Britain's royal family. Look at what began happening to Britain's royal family almost immediately after this change. Just look at what's happened to the family in the past 3 years. Well, it's not just Britain, as he said in that same quote. We're also going to be seeing a sharp decline in America and Judah as well. Don't be lulled to sleep because of the temporary resurgence. You're hearing a lot of comparisons, I guess. Maybe that's not the best word. Connections from this impeachment in the United States to the one that concluded, I guess it would be 21 years ago, right around this same time. Bill Clinton and the articles of impeachment there. 11 felonies listed out. At least there was some substance to the charges. Felonies. And here we have no crimes. We just have kind of the vague abuse of power or obstructing Congress because the president didn't agree with the way the Democrats were doing things, so he took things to the court. And they see this as obstruction. You can't go to the courts. They do it all the time. But they say, you can't go to the courts. That delays things. We've got to hurry. We've got to hurry and hurry and hurry. And so they'd hurried it through and then sat on it for a month. And then last week, the shameful display as they went about in front of the cameras. There's one case where Kamala Harris, she's hooting and smiling, and then when she realizes she's on camera, very sober. It's a sobering week, and we've got to be very serious about our responsibilities to carry out our constitutional duties. There they were, trying to put a serious face on it in front of the camera, and then laughing and cheering about it when they turned away from the camera, in most cases, I guess. I mean, you see Maxine Waters there. She didn't exactly hold back. Here's Nancy Pelosi on Bill Maher's show Friday night, and listen or watch them as they enjoy a nice fist bump over the impeachment proceedings. Clip three.
Thank you so much for waiting till we got back on the air before you started the impeachment. That deserved a fist bump. Thank you.
Thanks for waiting until we got back from the break so we could cover this on television, so that we could cover the circus, the sham. What a shameful display, as I say. Hugh Hewitt said that the impeachment trial, for most Americans, it's just a big yawn. It's a big yawner, he said, except for those in New York and Los Angeles, the media on both coasts, and the Democrats, of course, who are obsessed with it. They're obsessed with it, but most in America are not. They know it's a hoax. They know the president's right on this. It says here, never have so few rode so fervently for a destination that the rest of the world would almost certainly be happy to skip. These are the same people, speaking of those who are obsessed over this, the same people who thought Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller, the third, was sending a secret message using every fourth word in alternating paragraphs. He has the goods. Surely he has the goods. And then he came out last year and said, I really don't have anything on him. I tried and tried and tried. And so on a dime, they switch to or turn to Ukraine. They go from Russia to Ukraine, and then now they've been coming back to Russia. It's hard to even follow them. Hugh Hewitt has a radio program, and he said his listeners, they're not interested in these charges, these bogus charges. They know it's a big hoax. But they are watching to some degree or listening to some degree to see which Republicans now, because the House Republicans were pretty unified and together, and they fought back. Even as lopsided as that investigation was, Doug Collins was on Mark Levin's show last night. He was saying we couldn't call any of our witnesses. Only the witnesses that Adam Schiff wanted. And then they even had to be screened, remember, in the basement. And then now it switches over to the Senate, and you have these Democrats who are insisting, demanding, in fact, we get to call our witnesses. And then the few that say, well, if you call yours, we're going to call the Bidens and some others as well. How dare you? How dare you? The Democrats are supposed to control this from House to finish, from House to Senate to finish. He says, Hugh Hewitt, that his listeners are paying attention because they want to see which Republicans have a backbone, which ones are going to fight back. Now, as my father has said about President Trump, His willingness to fight back, it's something to behold. We'll have to see how many of them have a backbone to stand with the president, or if they're going to cave in to pressure from the radical left. You know, my father, when writing about the impeachment proceedings back in 1999, and then following hard on the heels of that, the debate over the 2000 election, it just brought the country to a standstill. Al Gore, when he lost to George W. Bush, and they wanted to get a Florida recount, and you had all those ridiculous images of hanging chads and Well, it was just a circus. This is the radical left. And my father back then talked about how that this was a turning point for the United States of America. We wrote about this some. I think you can read about it in Character in Crisis, No Freedom Without Law. Those two booklets were written about that time. But there's also an article. I think Sam used this in a program a while back. The Real Election Crisis. We wrote that in December of 2000. And my father just talked about how poisonous the environment would be now in Washington from here on out. How that Florida vote scandal would poison our political system from that point forward. And look at where we are today. That spirit, that satanic spirit, that scorched earth policy coming from the radical left. We certainly see it on full display today. My father wrote in that article from 20 years ago, does anybody really believe these men love the Constitution of this great land more than their man becoming president? This was over the 2000 election. Here is the heart of this crisis. I believe that they can't even relate to what I'm writing. They've been practicing this evil for too long. Putting self above the Constitution has become a way of life. This is a constitutional crisis, he said 20 years ago. They can't even relate to what I'm writing. And listen to them today, 20 years on. They trash the Constitution at every turn. They want to tear down statues. They want to say the founders are racist. And then as soon as they get a chance to impeach and convict a president, here they are talking about, well, we're just upholding the Constitution. Now they're constitutional originalists. They despise originalists. They do anything. We saw it in Kavanaugh's hardly a Justice Scalia. But look at what they did to that man's reputation. They hate law and order. These people are lawless through and through. And so they'll do, it doesn't matter if it's a double standard or if there's hypocrisy on display. It's do whatever is necessary to destroy, bring down the system. That's their aim. That's their objective. Well, God's been exposing a lot of it. And it's a shame, as I say, there aren't more people that are willing to stand up and to fight against it. Satan loves it. He loves it when people won't stand against him, when people just cower in fear. They're worried or fearful. Well, what will the press think? What will the liberal media think if I stand up for what's right? Well, even still, as I say, a lot of it's being exposed. Andy McCarthy, his article just the other day, why with Election Day only 10 months away would Speaker Pelosi stoke an impeachment vote that could be perilous for many of her members on the insistence that Trump was such a clear and present danger she could brook no delay, but then sit on the impeachment articles for a month, accomplishing nothing in the interim except to undermine the presidential bids of several Senate Democrats. In other words, so much of what she's doing, so much of what they're doing is backfiring. Temporary resurgence. I have another article here that I've been meaning to get to for several programs. It's a great piece at Real Clear Defense from a week or two ago. I've mentioned the headline at PJ Media a week or two ago as well. One could be forgiven for thinking the end times are upon us. This Real Clear Defense piece, it really is a sobering look. Again, we in talking about the temporary resurgence, we can't let that lull us into a false sense of security. And this article's talking about the next hot war, the next world war, the next war that involves entire nations. There is one that is coming. It's prophesied. We know this. Real Clear Defense doesn't think that way. But this article, it's some hard-hitting analysis. It says here already the forces of Russia, China, and Iran are conducting joint naval drills. Russian and American forces have already brawled with each other in Syria, and Russia has announced a key breakthrough in hypersonic weapons technology. It's only a matter of time before the situation becomes too tense and the fighting begins. Washington must be ready for this dark future, as preparations will likely help to delay it and give U.S. forces a fighting chance at victory. This is something that we better be preparing for, it says. And then it talks about America's ability to even survive such a war. This article says that it's inevitable that we're going to need to reconstitute the draft. This is not the trumpet. This is real clear defense. And to many people, even in the chattering class, this would just seem preposterous. A military draft? Are you crazy? What are you talking about? The point that's made here is preparation. Preparation is the key. I was watching a video the other day, the lead up to World War II, Winston Churchill, and how that they were so convinced, the Brits, they were so convinced that there would never be another war. Certainly not a world war, not like World War I. And so they not only tried to appease, but they themselves disarmed, which of course only made war more likely, because Hitler all the while was preparing for war. He was building up this military machine. Well, I mentioned they don't think much of Bible prophecy at Real Clear Defense, but maybe I should rethink that. Look at this quote. It says, when God told Noah to build the ark, he did not wait until the rain began. Similarly, U.S. policymakers have a moral duty to prepare the country for the coming storm right now. A lack of planning will ensure the worst possible scenario befalls the United States when a great power war begins. See, here the U.S., and you hear President Trump talk often about we've got the greatest, most powerful military in the world and such, but he's saying that even as we draw down, even as we want to withdraw from all these critical regions like the Middle East. And then when you factor in other prophecies about when the trumpet of alarm sounds, no one goes to battle, we don't think often enough about a surprise attack or an attack on our technology that prevents us from even hearing the alarm. This is something to think about. That's the point of this article. And if you don't prepare for it, we're going to find ourselves in the same position that the Allies did in 1939. Here, all through the 30s, Hitler and Germany, they were preparing for war. And here on this island, here in Britain, there was only one person preparing for war. That was Winston Churchill, and he happened to be out of power. So all that he could do was sound the alarm in the way that he knew how. Writing articles, giving speeches. And then he was just ridiculed and mocked for doing so. A political outcast living in the wilderness. He was right. Real Clear Defense says, one thing is certain, though. When another great power war erupts, it will not be relegated to being fought between two well-trained forces of professionals on distant battlefields, nor would the fighting be quick, short, and sharp. You see, the new age or the new generation of warfare, as we've heard from conservatives, laser-guided missiles or precision strikes, hitting a button in some military base in Georgia or Florida. We don't need boots on the ground. This is a new generation of warfare. It's not going to ever come back, those old days when you actually have boots on the ground fighting other boots on the ground. This is the way many people think. But Real Clear Defense says here, it will be waged along the lines of previous great wars wherein great powers possessed of relatively equal capabilities leveled each other. That's the way it happened in World War I. That's the way it went down in World War II. Such a total war, mind you, will devastate the world order. Pre-modern tribalism will quickly replace postmodern enlightenment, especially as the technology trappings of modernity were stripped away. Says the exchange of nuclear, not to mention biological and chemical weapons, will be a high probability as the combatants looked for leverage over one another. This is a realist. This is a realist approach to foreign policy. That, look, all of those nuclear weapons are there. They're going to be used. This is a point Herbert Armstrong made. This is a point my father's always made. They are there, and man has a history of using the weapons he creates. We've already used them to end the war. Like my father has said before, what happens when you start a war with nuclear weapons? It says here, this would especially be the case after early warning missile satellites. Well, that's picking it up in the middle of the thought. But the article talks about how the things that helped America win the last two world wars, those advantages have eroded the industrial capacity that we had. We won the Second World War largely because of that industrial might that we brought into the equation. What happens, though, when it's just man against man out on the battlefield? China has an army of 2.18 million men already, and Russia has more than a million men. And we know some of the prophecies of your Bible. Revelation 9, for example, speaks of a 200 million man army. Where could that come from? And that's for the last days? I thought those kinds of wars were over. Wars against nations. Nations rising against nations. Then you add all of the dependence that we have on technology, the United States. It says here at that Real Clear Defense piece, American troops will also have to learn to fight a pre-1970s manner where smart bombs will be dumber, quantity will be more preferable to quality, America's global logistical supply chain will not be secured, and any war will be as bloody as either of the world wars. It will also be a time when not even the American homeland will be spared from the devastation and the chaos of a great power war. You can see why I've been wanting to come back to this. There's just been a number of other things in the news to discuss, but this is a pretty accurate forecast, particularly when you understand Bible prophecies. And it's over at Real Clear Defense. It says, finally, U.S. military and its leaders have come to fetishize high technology and rely far too much on technology to make up for real weaknesses in its overall force structure. It says the Wunderwaffe will not save U.S. forces when a world war starts. U.S. policymakers today tend to forget that wars are still fought and won by men, not machines. American rivals have not forgotten this timeless truth. Russia hasn't forgotten this. China, that's why their armies are so massive. It's a timeless truth. Wars are still fought and won by men, by human beings. Well, you read it and it seems like a pretty bleak assessment there. But how about that? Coming from a worldly source, it's a sobering analysis. And really, when you compare it to some of the prophecies in the book of Revelation, what you just heard there from Real Clear Defense, it's a pretty optimistic forecast by comparison. Think about Revelation 9:16, the 200 million man army. Think about Ezekiel 7 and verse 14, when the trumpet sounds, they don't even go off to battle. Why? What happened? What took place that could bring something like this about? Think about what Jesus Christ said in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Great tribulation, so much so that if God didn't intervene, there would be no flesh alive. Those are the prophecies of God. You think that's a pretty bold analysis and real clear defense? Open your Bible and look at Matthew 24 and see what Christ had to say about the very last days. Well, if you want to study this further, if there's another booklet here we need to try to offer on TV soon as well. In fact, I think we did in this one we just taped Thursday. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. That was produced by this church just a year or two ago. You can delve into that book if you'd like to study further some of these prophecies of Jesus Christ. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can submit feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
In that Telegraph piece I quoted from at the start of the show about the hard Megxit, as it's been called, it says here, while the events of the past 10 days will undoubtedly have taken their toll on our 93-year-old monarch, I read this part earlier, it says, Her Majesty's decisive action, it reminds us of who is boss, not only of who is boss, but why. And then it says this, yet throughout it all, there has been one constant, a woman, this is speaking of the queen, a woman who at the tender age of 21 so deftly declared, my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service. This is what she told her British subjects back in the 1940s. I played those clips for you last week. Her motto, to serve. Here it is again, clip 5.
If we all go forward together with an unwavering faith, a high courage, and a quiet heart, we shall be able to make of this ancient commonwealth, which we all love so dearly, an even grander thing, more free, more prosperous, more happy, and a more powerful influence for good in the world than it has been in the greatest days of our forefathers. To accomplish that, we must give nothing less than the whole of ourselves. There is a motto which has been borne by many of my ancestors, a noble motto, I serve. Those words were an inspiration to many bygone heirs to the throne when they made their knightly dedication as they came to manhood.
A motto born by many of my ancestors, I serve. That's how she sees the monarchy today, or at least then, they were there to serve. The Telegraph says, as all around her have repeatedly lost their heads, the Queen is the modern-day Elizabethan equivalent of keep calm and carry on. She's the last remaining pillar of stability in the family. That's what this is saying. It says, moreover, it is her innate understanding, an acumen that appears to be lacking in many of her royal relatives, both past and present, that no one is bigger than the institution of monarchy. It says, there's a motto which has been borne by many of my ancestors, a noble motto, I serve, she said. This is the Telegraph quoting from that speech she gave in 1947, the one we played clips of last week. The Telegraph writes, for the Queen has always been of the view that the royals are servants of the crown. The crown is not and should never be their servant. In other words, duty comes first. And like the Telegraph brings out, you wonder how much of an earful Prince Harry got when he sat with her last Monday. Or if there were any other discussions before that, after Harry and Meghan made their announcement or submitted their announcement to the public. Duty comes first. That's what this queen believes, which is why she's so upset. She has a way of delivering the messages with some tact and diplomacy, but she is not happy about the course that Harry and Meghan have set themselves on. Last week, in that program a week ago, I took you through some verses in Matthew 20 where Jesus, in talking to his disciples, talked about how that he came here to serve. You remember the disciples asking about if they could be right at his right hand, serving at his right hand forever. And Christ said, you don't know what you're asking for. Oh yes, we want to be top leaders. We want to be right at the top of your royal family. And Christ said to them, look, follow my example. I didn't come to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give my life a ransom for many. That's Matthew 20 and verse 28. I came to give my life to this cause. I came to make the ultimate sacrifice. I came to be a true servant. That's why we in the church have been called. That very well could be our motto, a motto born by many of our ancestors. I serve, said the Queen back in 1947. Look at this example of Christ in Philippians 2. Verse 5, it says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. This mind of a servant, this same mind, who said he came to minister, who said he came to give his life as a ransom for many. Let that mind be in you. It says further in the Revised Standard, verse 6, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. Jesus took upon him the form of a servant. Everything that Jesus Christ did was motivated by an unselfish, outflowing concern for others. He gave no regard to reputation, position, status, people-pleasing, none of that. He just emptied himself into his service opportunities. This passage is, he impoverished himself. He made himself of no reputation. That's what verse 7 is saying. What a step down. This was the Son of God. This was the Word who became flesh. This is the example he set. He became poor. He was rich, but he became poor for our sakes. And here's an example in the British royal family today that was rich and they want more even. They want the best of both worlds. They want to be able to live a life free of responsibility and duty. But they want all the fabulous wealth. They want the cottages. They want the castles. They want everything. They want the fame, the fortune. How very different from what God is building in his royal family. And it's not like we're going to be without wealth. God wants to give us the universe. Hebrews 2, Psalm 8. Here, this earth is just a little pinprick, comparatively. And we get so caught up into materialism and things. It's not that we shouldn't lead a prosperous life or a life of abundance. Jesus came to give us that, John 10 and verse 10. But to set your heart on it, that certainly is, like Paul said, it's a root of all evil. It really is a root cause. One of them. There's others too. But compare the life that Jesus Christ, or the Word, had before coming in the flesh with what he submitted himself to. He made himself of no reputation. He humbled himself as a servant. Verse 8 says, "And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death," even the death of the cross. He humbled himself to make the ultimate sacrifice. Crucifixion. Scourging and crucifixion. He didn't deserve either. Verse 9, it says, "Wherefore God also has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name." That's what God will give to us if we commit our lives to service. If we come into the church, the work of God, and say, "I'm here to serve." That's my motto. It's been born of many of my ancestors. I serve. Verse 5 again, it says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." We have to let it in. It's not something that comes natural. It's not something that we're born with. Look at the world today. Look at how selfish and self-centered so many people are. They're not letting the mind of Christ in. Look at those of us in the church. And look at the battle we have every day to just submit to God's authority and to love him and to love fellow man and to love serving in this work. It's so easy to get selfish. It's so easy to put first the self, even when we have the Spirit of God, even when our minds are open to the truth of the Bible, even when we're actively working to let it in. It's still hard, isn't it? It's still a challenge. There's so many obstacles, and Satan's just pulling and pulling and pulling, and we're such a big target in the eyes of the devil. He wants to take us out. He wants us to obsess over self. He wants us to serve the self. He gives another example here in this chapter. Paul does. Philippians 2. Verse 19, it says, "But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy shortly unto you, that I also may be of good comfort when I know your state. For I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state." It's quite a compliment for young Timothy. And yet at the same time, it's some constructive feedback for other assistants who just didn't have that kind of natural care for others. They were just more selfish. Selfishly motivated. Verse 21, he says further, "For all seek their own, not the things which are Jesus Christ." All of them. All of them are selfishly motivated. All of them are just too self-absorbed to really give of themselves in service, to give themselves as a living sacrifice. That's what godly service is to sacrifice self, to sacrifice our time, our energy in service to others, to help others. That's the example that Jesus Christ set. You can't look at his life, his ministry, and say, "Yeah, it's a pretty normal life. I see it all the time." We don't see it at all in this world today. This is what the world needs to solve the problems that are mounting by the day. It needs the example, the service, the love, the government administration of Jesus Christ. It needs the laws of the Ten Commandments enforced. It needs the royal family committed to serving. Verse 22, Paul says further, "But you know the proof of him, that as a son with the Father, he has served with me in the gospel." He really did serve. He followed that motto, Timothy did, born by many of his ancestors. They served. They served. Verse 25, it says, "Yet I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but your messenger, and he that ministered to my wants, for he longed after you all and was full of heaviness because that he had heard you, or rather because that he had heard that he heard that they had heard he was sick." It's a little awkward in the way that it's worded. But here were the people worrying about Epaphroditus because he got sick and he couldn't meet with them. And then he heard that they were worried about him, and then he got worried for them. Verse 26, or verse 27. I better not read verse 26 again, as much as I butchered that. let's just move over verse 26. Verse 27, it says, "For indeed he was sick near unto death, but God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow." God intervened and healed this man. He just gave himself to the point of almost dying physically. And God had mercy on him and really blessed him, even physically. He didn't live forever, but he was healed. And how refreshing and uplifting that was for Paul as well. Verse 28, it says, "I sent him therefore the more carefully, that when you see him again, you may rejoice, and that I may be less sorrowful. Receive him therefore," verse 29, "in the eternal with all gladness, and hold such in reputation, because for the work of Christ," verse 30, "he was near unto death, not regarding his life, to supply your lack of service toward me." He was just there to fill in wherever he could help, in whatever way possible. What an example. Epaphroditus, Timothy, the Apostle Paul, and above all, Jesus Christ. Back to verse 3, it says, "Let nothing be done through strife and vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others." Don't be selfish. Don't look after your own things alone. But learn to be a servant. Learn to give to others. This is what we've been called to do. And verse 5, yet again it says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." We have to let it in. We have to humble ourselves before the mighty hand of God, as Peter said, and let God lead us, and let God guide us, and let God perform his mighty works, his wondrous works, through us. That's when life gets exciting. That's what makes life fulfilling. That's what brings true happiness into your life. That's what brings true happiness into God's royal family, is when we're all giving, when we're all serving. As it says in Acts 20, it's more blessed. It's so much more blessed to give than it is to receive. That's our duty. That's our responsibility. That's why we're here. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can submit feedback. We'll get to more feedback on tomorrow's program, hopefully. td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.